Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like health care, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. This week, we continue with our series focused on candidates for Congress in New Hampshire's 1st and 2nd districts. Over the next several weeks, you will hear from both Republican and Democratic candidates. In one-on-one interviews, each will have an opportunity to share their background, experience, and policy priorities. They'll also answer questions related to the nation's fiscal challenges and how, as members of Congress, they might work to resolve them. This week, you will hear from 1st District Congressional Candidate and State Senator Andy Sanborn, as well as 2nd District Congressional Candidate Dr. Stuart Levinson. But before we dive into today's discussions, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The Senate was able to pass a bundle of 4 of its 12 annual spending bills, with 7 appropriations bills now passed. This is the first time since 2000 that the Senate has been able to complete a majority of its spending bills by early August. The secret to their success has been a bipartisan effort to fight off partisan riders or amendments. This bipartisan movement will be tested in the coming weeks as a partisan showdown over funding for the border wall bruise, and when they will have to work with the House on compromise legislation. The House has been far more partisan in its appropriations bills. House and Senate negotiators are working through the August recess to reauthorize farm programs for another 5 years before the current authorization expires on September 30th. The biggest point of contention between the two versions of the bill is the future of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. One of the few points of bipartisan agreement in today's political climate is the need to improve the nation's aging infrastructure. The main sticking point is that an agreeable plan to address the funding gap between planned spending and federal revenue has yet to be found. A new plan coming out of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee suggests a possible solution, calling for the gas tax to increase under the plan, phased in over 3 years, and then eliminated after 10 years in favor of recommendations from a commission tasked with finding a new revenue model. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. Up next, I'll be joined on the show by New Hampshire Congressional Candidate and State Senator Andy Sanborn. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by New Hampshire Congressional Candidate, State Senator Andy Sanborn. Andy lives in Bedford with his wife. He has the entrepreneurial bug and has owned several businesses, including the Draft Sports Bar and Grill in Concord. He served 3 consecutive terms as a New Hampshire State Senator and has served as the state co-chair of presidential campaigns for both Ron Paul and Rand Paul. Andy is running as a Republican to represent the 1st Congressional District of New Hampshire. Thank you for joining the show, Andy.
Chase, thanks so much for having me today. Great times.
Well, it's a pleasure having you on Facing the Future. And I think before we jump into any fiscal policy specific topics, I want to give you a chance to introduce yourself, explain to the listeners why you're running to represent New Hampshire in Congress, and maybe what some of your top policy priorities are.
Absolutely. Again, thank you so much for everyone listening out there today. Thanks so much for tuning in. We really appreciate it, because it's obviously so important to always have a dialogue about where our country is today and where we're trying to take it. So for the record, I am Andy Sanborn, although I prefer people just call me Andy, because the fact of the matter is I never ran for office for the title. I never ran for the perks. I never ran for the special consideration. I ran because, like so many of you, I was just angry at my government, right? I'm a 4th-generation New Hampshire native. I'm a 3rd-generation business owner. I've started from scratch. Bought, expanded some 14 different operations in my life. I presently operate in the hospitality industry, as Chase had said. I do some prototype manufacturing. I do real estate development. And I also build and restore vintage race cars for any of you out there that like old classic race cars. My background is actually in finance and economics. I spent, you know, a decade and two decades in commercial and investment banking. And so I'm a business guy, right? And frankly, was very proud and happy for who I am and what I was doing and how I was living my life. And for me, never wanted to be in the political arena, never wanted to run for office. I'd never held a sign. I'd never given money. I'd never made phone calls. I'd never done any of it. I was just kind of living my life until government showed up. And when I made a decision to open up a restaurant, which you mentioned, which I built from scratch, during that build process, I had five different government bureaucratic agencies coming in over the course of 6 months, trying to tell me how to build it or how to change it. Or one agency would tell me to do one thing, and the next agency would come in and say, I know they said do that, but now you need to do this. And I'm Irish, right? So I'm a product of Irish immigrants. Our family came to America in the 1840s during the Great Potato Famine. And one of the things I love about the Irish is we are happy warriors for everything we believe in. And we believe that no matter how hard we fight about issues, we need to save time for beer and burgers afterwards. But we are an emotional group of people. And like I said, I just got really frustrated with how government was treating us. And it gave me that ability, Chase, to wake up one day and say, what's going on with this relationship? Because I don't remember it being like this when I, you know, when I had my political awakening per se. I'm kind of a Ronald Reagan Republican, right? Where I believe that tomorrow's a better day and that the future's, you know, is unlimited of what we can do and how we can come, and the single most important social program we should ever be working on that will solve every single problem we've ever had is making sure people have a good job. And you can't be pro-job if you're not pro-business. So I got frustrated, ran for office, as you said, became one of our state senators. I'm a four-term state senator. I'm the chairperson of tax policy for the state of New Hampshire. So if you do like tax cuts, I am your guy, because I'm the first guy in 30 years to actually cut taxes in the state. And I spent time both in the Commerce Committee, in charge, again, chairman of the Commerce Committee, which oversees banking insurance regulations. And I've been on the Energy Committee as well, which is obviously an important topic of what's happening in America today. So I'm just kind of a well-rounded, ordinary, everyday guy. You know, I thank God every day I'm smarter than I look. So it's been great. So now, as you know, I've made that decision because I believe in term limits. People from around the country and here in New Hampshire have all come and said, look, we need to find someone who wants to run for office, who can win as a Republican, and who really embodies that, you know, that business, fiscal, frugal, problem-solving thing that I think we need right now in Washington. So it's been a great race. We're having a great time.
So I want to pick up off of a phrase that you said, and that was happy warrior. Say you're down in Washington, D.C. You're the congressman for the 1st District of New Hampshire. What policy issues are going to be your happy warrior issues? What are you going to really champion and work on when you're in Washington?
Sure. So, you know, it's a big question. You know, clearly, all of you listening out there today probably join Chase and I in saying, yes, it kind of is a swamp. No, they're not getting much done. Our spending is out of control. Our debt and deficit is just staggering. And clearly, we need to get our fiscal house in order, because, you know, that's really my bailiwick. But we also have to remember that, you know, what I believe is the single most important responsibility of Congress is to keep our people safe. And maybe 30 or 40 years ago, it was, we're concerned about someone, you know, invading America or lobbing some sort of a weapon at us, you know, be it nuclear or be it chemical, whatever. But, you know, it's a much broader thing today, that people want to be safe and secure, that the money they have in the bank is not going to be evaporate someday, and, you know, that their house isn't going to get hacked into. So when we think about security today, it's a much broader thing. So to me, first and foremost is keeping our people safe. That's the job, right? The second most important thing is making the thing run again, bringing some level of confidence to the people of America that their elected officials are actually coming together and actually trying to make it run. Now, we understand there always needs to be some level of conflict, because in debate and in the political arena, we're all trying to solve the same problem, but we're coming to it from two different places. So we need to be able to compromise at some level. We need to be able to actually make it work. Now, you know, Chase, here in New Hampshire, for those of you who are listening who are not from New Hampshire, we do things differently in our state and the legislature that makes us work. Every bill introduced is required to have a public hearing and to have a vote. Every bill introduced is not allowed to have any non-germane amendments. We're required to actually balance our budget every single year. So if we could just bring those three things to Washington, D.C. and vote on stuff and actually hold hearings and do the people's work, I think it would go a long way to proving to people that we can get the job done.
Let's go back to the big picture issue you brought up earlier, and that was government spending, national debt and deficit. It sounds like fiscal responsibility would be a priority for you in Congress. What would be your overall take on getting us to a path of maybe reducing budget deficits, maybe even balancing the budget, or at least stabilizing the national debt?
Any and all of the above, right? I mean, it's a very complicated issue. The numbers are big. The commas are dramatic. But at the end of the day, we need to get our government to live like your house lives, that you recognize you bring in X amount of money and you can't spend more than that. And then all of a sudden, like in your house, and not your personal house, but you know, you might have too much debt or too much charge card debt or have overextended yourself or for whatever reason and lost someone lost a job. But you've got this huge debt behind you need to take care of. Now, we know economically, because you know my background's in finance and economics, that it's going to come from three different ways, right? It either comes because we spend less money and we can start to actually spend less than we bring in, so therefore we have some benefits. We bring in more money. Or at some level, we also need to recognize that when we see inflation creep up on us, that that's going to help reduce the deficit itself, which becomes a little bit more complicated. So all of you economists listening out there, you know what I'm talking about. But for people who are not economists, just trust me. Interest rates goes up, the deficit will come down. But all that being said, at the end of the day, the reality is we need to send a bunch of people to Washington, D.C. that have this vision that we're going to live within our means, and we need to find our way to get there.
So let's talk about the way to get there. In terms of getting the House in order, on the spending side, mandatory spending being one mm-hmm. of two primary categories, we're looking at about two-thirds of the federal budget. Discretionary spending is about a third of the federal budget, and it's a diminishing third. Mm-hmm. So how do you reverse that trend, or what's the approach you would take to at least get that overall dynamic a little more balanced, a little more in order?
Sure. So again, I get back to this whole all of the above at some level, right? A, we need to do everything we can to make our economy continue to grow and thrive so we have true economic growth. Now, Chase, you've seen that I've done that here in New Hampshire, that we cut taxes with the promise and the belief, just like when Ronald Reagan did, that the economy would grow and it expand and we'd end up with more revenue coming in, even though the tax rate was lower. Now, you've seen that. We just announced that our state brought in about $174 million more than what we had budgeted. And so it gives you extra money, which you can use to start paying stuff down. So job number one, let's make our economy the best it can possibly be. Let's grow it and make it excellent and do what we know we need to do as business owners and finance people to make our economy grow. We can still cut taxes and end up with more revenue and things we can do. We can repatriate the $4 trillion we're seeing abroad and bring that back, which you know the president is doing right now to spur more economic growth in America. So number one, strong economies, most important thing we can do. Now, as we start looking at non-discretionary spending, you know, on one hand, you hear people who get nervous or our friends on the other side of the aisle can sit there and say, oh, my God, if you touch Medicaid, if you touch Social Security, touch any of these programs, the world's going to come to an end. You're going to throw people out in the street. And that's not the point. That's just the rhetoric and the hyperbole that's coming from people who might not understand it. Maybe we need to stop and look back and say, all right, how have these programs expanded dramatically in the past 20 years? Social Security is no longer a program that's solely about retirement in your later years. And let me be very clear for the record, unequivocal. If you are getting Social Security, if you are near Social Security, do not be concerned. There is no way I personally would ever vote to change that because we made you a promise. And one thing that the political class needs to learn is that if you make people a promise, you got to deliver on the promise. All these other programs that are happening are taking money from Social Security, that taking money from Medicare and taking money from Medicaid. So they become big behemoth, spend much other monies that they weren't originally intended for. So we need to go back. We need to really look at what is important and what truly is non-discretionary. At the same token, we need to look at non-discretionary, right? Look, I told you, I believe in a strong national defense. It's very, very important to me. I believe that there's a role for government to help those that are truly in need. But we know right now that, you know, we're jacking shrimp up on cocaine to see what their sex life is. I'm just not sure that's money our government should be spending. We're building, you know, gas stations for $46 million in the Middle East and Afghanistan that we've actually never even sold a gallon of gas out of. So, I mean, there are things we're spending money on that a fiscal conservative like me would kind of raise their hand and say, not sure we should spend that. And as Ronald Reagan had said, right, $1 million here, $1 million there, sometimes it adds up to billions. The same principles apply.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with New Hampshire congressional candidate Andy Sanborn. We're discussing his policy priorities as well as his take on the nation's fiscal challenges. And I want to follow up on something you just said there, Andy. You talked a lot about economic growth and getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse in some of these programs. It's true that we've been seeing pretty strong economic growth over the last couple of years. It's been sustained, and we saw a bit of a spike earlier this year. But many economists look at the trajectory of, say, our growing debt and deficit, the level of revenue that's coming away from the budget as a result of tax cuts, and think that the economy will actually taper off a bit, and thus we won't have enough economic growth to support that level of spending. How do we, from your perspective, get to a larger level of economic growth? And do you think that is enough to correct the issue?
No, I don't think it's enough all by itself, because I don't believe there's not a single silver bullet to solve our problems. With $21 trillion in debt, with deficits could be facing $1 trillion a year, it's going to be a much more holistic, all-of-the-above approach, right? Reinvesting in America, reinvesting in companies, letting corporate America actually grow and thrive like it did in the 80s, and protecting at some level. Now, look, I'm not a guy that believes in tariffs, so let's get that on the table right now, because I believe in the free market. What we see today with the repatriation of all this money that's slowly but surely coming back into America right now, and the opportunity to have good diplomatic relations with people all over Earth to allow an expansion of American-made products to try and solve some traditional crises that we've had and bad relationships we've had. I mean, look, ask yourself this simple question, right? That we don't have peace in the Koreas today. And the fact that President Trump might actually deliver peace in the Koreas, well, like the president or not, I mean, I'm completely supporting the president in this regard, right? But this is going to be as important as watching the Berlin Wall fall. And what will it mean to economies, not just North Korea's economies, to actually see an influx of cash in economic development and in having a society that becomes more free market and embraces this capitalistic sense? But what's the opportunities for American companies to go deliver products over there and go help develop over there? All that is part of this whole economic engine we talk about. Where are the places on Earth today that America is not involved in? And if we can continue to peacefully expand who we are and build relationships, I honestly think we can fix it.
And Andy, you also mentioned Social Security. Yep. And put out the broad statement that anyone who's currently retired or maybe even about to retire, they shouldn't worry.
Absolutely.
About reform coming.
Yep.
The Social Security trustees recently issued their 2018 report on the trajectory of that particular program and say it's rapidly heading toward insolvency by 2034.
Correct.
If we wait until then to make reforms to get the system a little more healthy, you're looking at a potential 24% benefit cut across the board. So we've got to act between now and 2034. What do you view as necessary reforms?
Sure. So for the record, I'm 56 years old. I do not believe I get Social Security. I have operated my life under the premise that I don't believe I get benefits from it. But again, let me be emphatically clear. If you are in Social Security, if you are on the age of coming up to Social Security, we made a promise. We cannot break that. And I would never vote to do that. Like it or don't like it, it's the way the program is. We promise these people. We need to deliver on the promise. And that's one thing you'll find that I'll do as an elected official is I actually tell you what I think and I will stand behind it. We do need to look at all these programs that have been bopping up in the past 20 years. And there's a tremendous amount of additional expense in all three of those big programs, right? Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, that have been new spending and new programs. And we need to take a very hard look at that. At the same token, I also am a guy that believes in defined contribution plans, not defined benefit plans. So I think for new people coming into the system, we need to find that hybrid, right? We need to find a way that millennials like you are encouraged to save for your own retirement. Clearly, we know as government has continued to take money out of it every time it's been solvent in the benefit package today, it is unsustainable. We need to look at it and we need to, you know, figure out how we're going to fix it. And I think there's enough things to fix when you look at just what's the added benefits and stuff we've added in the past few years, that we can make some significant changes without, you know, stripping away benefits from people in their older years, because that's not something I'd support. So, you know, I believe we need to means test it, right? That's something easy and we should be looking at today. You know, it was supposed to be a safety net. If you have paid into the system your whole life and you don't have a lot of assets and you don't have a lot of income, it needs to be a safety net for you. But I'm not sure Warren Buffett needs to collect Social Security, ladies and gentlemen. So at some level, I think we need to do some means testing of people that are in there. if we know that people are working longer, and you know, at 62 to 65, maybe they're working at 67 to 70 to 75. Who knows what that number is today? And there's actuaries who have actually looked at that kind of stuff. So we need to say at some level that, you know, do we push it out a couple of years? And we know that every time we've looked at those types of numbers, the long-term influence in the corpus of the value is very, very significant. When I talk about reforms, yeah, it's not just about sending people to a new program or cutting. There are things we could be doing today. And yeah, I mean, I think means testing today is something American people would listen to.
About 20% of our economy is spent on healthcare in some capacity, and it's becoming even more expensive per capita to provide healthcare for this generation that is aging. What do you think needs to happen to sort of level out that cost curve and make any kind of healthcare system sustainable?
Healthcare is something I consider myself to be very, very knowledgeable about. I mean, look, globally, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, did not work. It's crushed us financially. Even on and above the disaster of what that has really brought to us, there's a couple things we need to look at right up front. First and foremost, we need better honesty and transparency in the medical system. Let me give you a perfect example. When I became chairman of Health and Human Services, if you needed an MRI or a CAT scan in a New Hampshire hospital, it cost about $8,800. Now, a good friend of mine who's in the medical business saw this, had an employee that needed it, couldn't afford it, ultimately went out and bought his own MRI, now has the best MRI in the state of New Hampshire, and he can give you an MRI today for $650. And it's a mile from the one that charges $8,800. So we need to bring some free market, some capitalism, some cost transparency measures just to the medical system all by itself. And again, Chase, we can spend hours talking about the roadblocks and the corruption and I don't want to use the word shady deals, right? The fact that all players in operating in healthcare today are incentivized to make it more expensive, not less expensive. I've just spent the last 8 years of my life fighting for ways to make healthcare more affordable and more transparent. And if they let people like me to implement policies to make an MRI $650 versus $8,800, and we can go right down the list of all your medical care, we can have dramatic changes in the cost of healthcare. So before we talk about limiting people's access to healthcare, which again becomes that political roundtable you hear from one side yelling at the other side, why don't we come together and work together and find ways to bring free market solutions to actually cut the cost of care before we start talking about giving or taking away?
One last question, and still on the healthcare topic, and it's just because it's such a large expenditure in the budget, and that is Medicare, also projected to be insolvent by 2026. Are there any specific reforms that you think need to take place in Medicare in the short term as we work our way to a more cost-effective system?
Yeah, so look, when I look at Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, it's all the same types of things, right? That let's take Social Security out for a second. Just look at Medicare and Medicaid, which were designed to be and should be about providing medical care for those who don't have the money to do it themselves, or Medicare for people that are older, as we know, right? So we get back down to the cost transparency needs to be number one, that we need to have a real initiative so people actually know what it's costing them and where they're going to get it. In the state of New Hampshire, we actually made a program that allowed people to go online and look at the cost of a medical procedure before they got it. And if they went to the low-cost provider, we actually cut them back a check. And it saved the state of New Hampshire millions and millions and millions of dollars every single year just by helping people direct to the low-cost provider. I mean, I've never seen anything in my life like it where if you need a CAT scan, right now you go to the most expensive place or you go someplace you have absolutely no idea what it costs. There's nothing else you buy like that. So before we start talking about, you know, structural changes of who gets care and when they get care and what access is, let's make it affordable. Let's make it transparent. Let's do the basics that all of us do as business owners every day to try and solve problems. And I think we'll find there's a lot of fat in that bear.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and New Hampshire congressional candidate Andy Sanborn discuss his policy priorities and approach to tackling our nation's fiscal policy challenges. Thank you for joining the show, Andy.
Thanks so much for having me. Truly appreciate it. Everyone, remember, September 11 is the primary. We'd love to have your vote.
Up next, I'll be joined on the show by another New Hampshire congressional candidate, Stuart Levinson. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I am your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the program by New Hampshire congressional candidate Dr. Stuart Levinson. A board-certified rheumatologist, Stuart came to New Hampshire 20 years ago. He currently lives in Hopkinton. From 2011 to 2017, Stuart was the chairman of the Department of Medicine at the VA Medical Center in Manchester. He was also the medical director of the VA New England Network from 2014 to 2017. He's a graduate of Queens College, received his MD from the Ohio State University. Stuart is running as a Republican to represent the 2nd Congressional District of New Hampshire. Thank you for joining the show, Stuart.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on Facing the Future. And I think before we jump into any fiscal policy related issues, I want to give you a chance to introduce yourself to our listeners, maybe share why you're running for Congress to represent New Hampshire, and perhaps what some of your top policy priorities might be.
Well, my name is Stuart Levinson. You can check me out further at levinsonforcongress.com. Many people know me as my role as a whistleblower at the VA in Manchester. I was the chairman of the department, as you kindly mentioned, as well as the medical director. And while there had always been problems at the VA, most of those problems I was able to deal with. Something started to snowball. Doctors, nurses, patients would come to me and things wouldn't get fixed. So I went to meet with Ann Custer, and unfortunately, she did nothing. I went to the Boston Globe. I knew at that point that I had become a whistleblower. I had risked it all doing that. Becoming a whistleblower, I risked my career, my medical license, even my freedom by doing that. But it had to be done. That's the definition of integrity. That's the definition of leadership where I was trained. So I decided that we need better people in Congress. We need to get rid of the career politicians and restore accountability.
So, Stuart, having worked in the VA and being a doctor yourself, it sounds like healthcare might be a top policy priority for you. So let's talk a little bit about that. Our current healthcare system, many would view as sort of run amok, whether it's because the ACA has been hampered along the way or perhaps we need an overhaul in the system. We spend about 20% of our economy on healthcare as a nation. The government subsidizes a lot of our healthcare through Medicare, Medicaid, the ACA network, as well as the VA. So I wonder if you could share your perspective on healthcare, perhaps how we can help reduce cost in the long run, or what kind of reforms you'd pursue as a member of Congress.
Well, healthcare is a pivotal issue. It's certainly not my only issue. There are many other issues that need to be addressed, but healthcare is certainly important. People don't talk about it very much this time of the year because it's not really affecting them as much as during open season when they see the sticker shock of the new premiums on the exchanges. They went up 54% last year. They're going up about 40% this year. So come October, when there's open season, this will probably be a huge issue for the upcoming election, but something has to be done. Enough is enough. People can't afford a mortgage because they're paying health care premiums. And then when they have the health insurance, they can't afford the co-pays and the co-insurance. And our elected officials, they don't seem to care because their health care is provided by you, the American people. And those are the types of issues that we need to address. If they had skin in the game, you can bet they wouldn't be functioning under this broken system. We need to stop compensating health care providers, hospitals, doctors, what have you, on a cost plus basis. It's almost like they get a piece of every action they order. You get an MRI for a simple backache. It upcodes it to another a payment level. They give you a ream of paper when you leave the doctor's office. It's called meaningful use, and Medicare is able to bill at a higher level. So the system is set up to be an out-of-control engine that merely overcharges. And health insurance companies, they're another part of the problem. It's the only industry where executives are rewarded for how little they provide, not how much they provide. So we have to change a lot of things. I'm a big believer in the free market. If we could have interstate competition, for example, the exchanges in New Hampshire, there's only one provider. That's Anthem, I believe. How can you have competition when the government sets up an exchange and there's only one provider for pretty dismal insurance that doesn't cover very much and has huge co-payments? Clearly, that's not the best way. Medicare can't even negotiate for drug prices. So there's no incentive to control drug prices except when your doctor is told by your insurance company, oh, you can't get that. It's not on the formulary. So I could go on for hours about how broken things are in healthcare, and I do have specific and obtainable solutions, such as health savings accounts that don't go back to your employer once you haven't used the money. So there are many ways of improving healthcare. It's just that the people in government have no interest in doing so.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of those solutions. You alluded to a few of them. You just mentioned HSAs. You mentioned interstate competition. What other solutions or proposals would you put forth as a member of Congress to help right the ship, specifically within the ACA markets right now?
Drug prices. It's funny that we can't negotiate interstate yet when you live along the borders. Let's say a lot of Texans who have medical problems, they go to Mexico to get their prescriptions filled, and you say, oh, it's Mexican. No, it's the same drugs. They're actually blister-packed with a laser seal that you can tell if they've been tampered with. I had more faith in those prescriptions than I did in some of those filled in areas of Texas. So you can't use that excuse. So drug prices are a big one. I think drug prices are probably the single largest expenditure for ambulatory, meaning out-of-hospital care. So if we make a dent in the drug prices, then that will have real effects on lowering the cost of health care. Health savings accounts. You put in some. Your employer puts in some pre-tax dollars, and you become a policeman looking for prices. There are tests that vary by 300% from one hospital to another, and it's not a trend. So a CAT scan may be more expensive at hospital A, and MRI might be less expensive there. So you should have the freedom to know where those prices are, and that you go which best suits you because you're paying out of pocket in your own health savings account. Granted, a safety net is required for those that fall short. We are always going to have a safety net. But if you look at it this way, most of us aren't old enough to remember before the Truth in Lending Act that got through, where banks had to post their interest rates. Before that, they didn't have to post them out in the lobby so you could shop around for a car loan or for a mortgage and get the best rate. Well, imagine if healthcare facilities had on their website what an MRI cost, what a colonoscopy cost, and it was a final bottom line cost, you'd be able to go, and even if insurance was paying for it, you can bet that prices would be more competitive.
Stuart, let's talk a little bit more about drug prices. How do you institute lower drug prices in the current environment that we have? I know we talked a little bit about competition, but how do you sort of facilitate that besides, say, an HSA?
Okay. Well, one thing that bothers me is the fact that many drugs, the basic research was paid for by the American people through NIH grants, other Department of Health grants, even VA grants. So the American people are paying for the development of a drug that they won't be able to afford once it comes to market. Under my system, if a drug company accepts NIH money or VA money, Department of Health money, then there have to be some price controls that they're willing to abide by. Also, how the FDA functions right now, it's anti-competitive. Drug testing is very expensive. It's often a good portion of the front money to get a drug approved. And what drug companies do is they troll the market for drugs that are either out of patent or have never been patented and try to find ways of patenting them. There's one drug that's been on the market for close to 100 years that has many uses. Before the drug companies figured out that there was no patent on it, the VA used to pay something like 2 cents a tablet. The drug's called colchicine, by the way. The drug company did a testing on it. They did invest some money, but it was very little. And now the drug, which is widely used, is several dollars a tablet. That's just not fair to the American people. Interstate competition is also key to bringing down drug prices. And yes, doctors have to be more aware that the newest, best drug is not necessarily better than the one that's been on the market for 50 years.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with New Hampshire congressional candidate Stuart Levinson. We're discussing his policy priorities as well as his take on the nation's fiscal challenges. And I think, Stuart, I want to transition here to talk a little bit about Medicare. The trustees for that program recently came out and said by 2026, the hospital insurance trust fund will be depleted. The program is also heavily subsidized by general tax revenue. So are there any specific reforms you want to see in the Medicare system besides, like you mentioned earlier, allowing Medicare to negotiate its own drug prices?
Well, Medicare provides an important source of health care funding for a good portion of the population, more as the population gets older. So it's very important that we don't mess with it in terms of making sure that patients can get the care they need. But otherwise, Medicare is a bloated system with excess bureaucracy that is completely broken on the payment and charging side that just doesn't make sense. I believe a lot of Democrats who are campaigning on Medicare for all, why not? More free stuff. Somebody was speaking to a college student and they're supporting Bernie Sanders because they want a free college education. Well, it's not really free. Somebody is paying for it, and the same is true of Medicare, which is the reason it's on such shaky fiscal ground. First, deregulation. There's so the reams of regulation with Medicare create difficulties in themselves, and they have a ripple effect throughout the healthcare economy. We talk about tort reform. Well, the tort in many cases was the fact that the Medicare arcane regulations weren't obeyed. So if the regulations were obeyed or the regulations were simpler, then there wouldn't have been a tortious act because people can't figure out how to abide by the rules. So if there's anyone who wants to sue you, chances are if they go through the rules, they can find violations. So if we just simplified the rules, we probably wouldn't even need tort reform in many cases. So the regulatory overreach by Medicare is probably the biggest factor. I know of doctors, healthcare institutions, they're always living in the fear of audits by Medicare. They send letters to patients under the guise of fraud and abuse, creating a rift between the doctor and the patient, and this is simply unacceptable. So while patients are getting care, it's delivered in the most inefficient way possible.
And just one more question on Medicare, Stuart, and that is, when it comes to reforming the program, besides, say, tort reform or allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices, do you think there needs to be any alteration in, say, the level of the payroll tax or the level of premiums that are paid by Medicare beneficiaries in the system now or in the future?
Well, that's a very good question because I believe there's so much waste in the system. When I was with the VA, I would estimate there was about 30 to 35% waste. So if you can cut the waste, I mean, politicians are always campaigning on cut the waste, and it never happens. And that's because you have to do broad strokes that people are unwilling to do. And I feel like we have the current president. He's not afraid to make a few waves, obviously. And to an extent, that's what we need, the outsiders, the reformers, to get into office and not be afraid to rock the boat. Because I don't think we need to increase the tax rates, the payroll tax, which keeps edging up by not having a ceiling on the income levels. If we can make it more efficient, I'm sure we can cut a good portion of that waste, and it wouldn't have to be on a tax side. Because as I talk about tax policy in general, no matter how big the fire hose, you can't fill a sieve.
So, Stuart, we've been talking quite a bit about a mandatory spending program in Medicare, and there's another big mandatory spending program in Social Security whose trustees have also come out and said it is also on its way to insolvency in terms of its trust funds by 2034. Do you think there are any reforms that you would pursue as a member of Congress in Social Security, whether it's adjusting the program so it's better off long-term for current and future generations, or do you think we're at a transition point where maybe it might look different for the upcoming generation?
Yes. The issue is that Social Security is being depleted, but on the other side of that equation, you have retirees, you have people that are getting ready to retire, even younger workers. They're planning on Social Security as being part of their retirement, and people take a long time to come up with retirement plans, so you can't pull the rug out from under them. This is a very important concept. I believe all attempts at Social Security reform have been unsuccessful largely because they've been threatening current workers. This is a problem that's not going away, so the easiest fix is to get started with the people just entering the workforce, just people that haven't yet begun planning for retirement. And you could come up with a plan, which I'm sure they would find very satisfactory, because there's a very different thinking between different generations. Millennials have a different way they plan their career. For example, in my generation, homeownership was the holy grail. Everyone wanted to own a home. It was part of the American dream. A lot of younger people now, they consider home ownership to be something to bear. Why would you want to own a home? You'll have to sell it. You'll be working to pay a mortgage. I'd rather just rent. That's a personal choice. That's what makes America such a great country. So we can plan ahead, but we have to start planning with those who aren't embedded in the system yet. And then we could come to an agreement that will work, that will ensure the solvency going forward. But the real problem is Congress. There is no resolve. They talk about it, and hopefully you'll lose interest and be thinking about the next crisis in the newspaper, and they'll get away with having not taken a stand again.
And we've been talking a lot about spending, and there's one more category of spending I do want to get to before we switch over to the revenue side, and that is discretionary spending, which is about a third of the budget. Are there any particular areas of discretionary spending? So we're talking about defense, education, transportation, that you would make a priority in Congress, and if you're looking at investing more in those areas, how would you go about paying for them?
Well, that's just it. The key is how you pay for things. And unless you control spending, it doesn't matter how you plan on paying for things. So I would look at each program, see what's needed. Look at the Defense Department. If you look historically during the Cold War, a lot of very high cost defense spending was predicated on Soviet programs that didn't even exist once we were able to establish the so-called peace dividend. When the Soviet Union and communism collapsed, we realized that many of the programs that we were defending against were empty shells. So we need better intelligence, because the problem is a lot of congressmen are well lobbied by defense contractors, so they want to buy into it, so they're not being independent. That's the real problem, that we have Congress people who are career politicians, and the major issue that I'm running on is get rid of the career politicians, restore integrity and accountability, and then you'll see that spending goes down without causing defense to be endangered. We all want a safe country. We all want the same things in that regard. We just have to be given honest information and go forward making those decisions in an educated fashion.
All right, Stuart, last major topic. Let's talk about tax reform a little bit. We've got growing budget deficits. Our total national debt is over $21 trillion. We're on track to have trillion-dollar annual deficits beginning as early as next year and continuing forward at that level, which is something we've never seen as a country. So we just had a tax code overhaul that projects to add about $1 trillion to that national debt over the next 10 years. Would tax reform have looked different for you if you were in Congress?
Well, first, let me say that we keep ignoring the fact that within reason, when you lower tax rates, you end up with more tax revenue, you get greater growth in the economy. No one ever thought we'd get 4% growth in GDP. And that 4% is actually a larger real number, because the economy is much larger now. So 4% of a larger number is a large amount. So I believe that tax reform actually was a great shot in the arm to the economy. Businesses were giving bonuses to their workers. Unemployment went historically low levels. We never thought we'd see this type of economic growth. At least the Democrats didn't think we'd see this type of economic growth. So we have to keep that in mind, that if you raise taxes, ultimately I think you'll be putting a stranglehold around the economy in real people's pockets. I challenge somebody to walk down Main Street and find a minimum wage job. So there's a lot that can be done to improve the lives of people without raising taxes. And as far as deficits go, at 4% GDP, if we can control spending to just current levels, the deficit will actually shrink. It's only when GDP either goes lower in growth or spending goes up that the deficit will increase. So we have a golden opportunity right now to try to control the deficit.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and New Hampshire congressional candidate Dr. Stuart Levinson discuss his policy priorities and approach to tackling our nation's fiscal policy challenges. Thank you for joining the show, Stuart.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. Again, please take a look at my website, levinsonforcongress.com. I was a whistleblower. I'm not a politician. I will go to serve you.
Next week, I'll be joined on the show by congressional candidates Naomi Andrews and Lynn Blankenbecker. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.